you had in the sequel, The Witness to Roswell, the one that just came out, you've got a number of players that you've been talking to and following that all add something to the story. Let's go through some of them real quickly, okay? The Air Force hitman, again, Hunter Penn, sent to
Roswell. Yes. Hunter Penn. Now, when this occurred, they, as far as the military was concerned, it was easy to contain the story. They shipped certain airmen out to other bases. They held meetings in hangars of the entire squadron in some cases, and the commander would get up there and say, "Fellas, whatever you think is going on isn't going on." And if you want to read about it, you can read about it in Leavenworth. So the message was clear not to talk ever about this again. The problem was the controlling the civilians who were either eyewitnesses or who knew about the bodies, especially in some way.
Were there many people?
Well, yes. Normally, in rural New Mexico, when there's an air crash, the civilians get there first. They pocket souvenirs and what have you. And yes, there were many civilians that got to the. There were three crash sites, as we believe, and quite a number of them got to one or more of those.
And what do you think happened? By the way, how could these objects come from? Gosh knows how many. Light years away, probably in a mothership, I would guess. But what happened to them? How did they crash?
Well, that question is often asked, George. How could it come from Alpha Centauri, let's say, all the way to Earth, only to crash? How could that happen? Well, the answer is we don't know. We can speculate.
Yeah.
That based on witness testimony, starting with Mac Brazel and some of his neighbors, that there was a heavy thunder and lightning storm on the evening of July the 3rd, 1947. And if you've ever been in Mexico at this time, you've never seen lightning like this. At least I haven't, coming from the Philadelphia area. I've never seen lightning like this. And so Mac and a few of the neighbors thought they heard an explosion that wasn't a thunderclap. It was different than a thunderclap, but they thought they heard an explosion during this thunder and lightning storm. Well, the next day, Mac goes out to check his fence, check his sheep, and there he finds this field full of strange debris. And they're all, you know, they're of different types. Many are rigid that you can't bend them or do anything to them. Others are things that you can wad up, pieces of what looks like metal, but you can wad it up in your hands and hold it over a flat surface and let it go, and it'll flatten out before it hits the surface. So the speculation, George, at least I think Don and I agree with this, is that it was struck by lightning. The craft, whatever it was made out of, exceeded its tensile strength and came apart. And there was an inner cabin that was not breached, and it was the inner cabin that finally wound up closer to Roswell, and we call that the impact site. That's not the site that Brazel found, but the final resting place of the inner cabin or escape capsule or whatever you want to call it. But we think it was lightning. We've heard stories about, it was shot down, and we have no evidence of that.
No, not at all. Now, you talk about in the book how Mac Brazel's daughter recants her story. What happened there? That was what, Bessie Brazel?
Yes, Bessie would become one of the star witnesses, along with counterintelligence officer Sheridan Cabot, in their Mogul report in September of 1994. And what was interesting is that after we had first interviewed her back in 1989, she already was in a bit of a dispute with her own brother, Bill Jr., about whether she was even there or not. And I remember after we first talked to her, and then I immediately went back to her brother, and he shouted right into the phone, "What is she talking about? She wasn't even there." And I caught her in a number of contradictions, because at the time she was a 14-year-old, you know, teenage girl, and they had their main house down in Tularosa, New Mexico, where her mother, her rest of her family resided, and Mac was simply the ranch foreman up in the Corona area. And the ranch house didn't have electricity, no running water, no telephone, no TV, no radio, nothing. What would a teenage girl be spending the summer up at such a place when she had a regular home?
Yeah, exactly. She'd be bored out of her mind.
Precisely. So we kept coming back to her, and then she even finally sat down with her own brother. And before she passed away, and, you know, concerning a number of other circumstances involving the family, as far as this, the feeling that they are still being watched, that they still receive, as far as threatening phone calls, even up to this day, she finally accepted the fact that it was a separate incident altogether. They were constantly picking up weather balloons on that ranch. And at times she would spend some time with her dad. And they would gather up, they'd go out and gather up wreckage and balloon material, because cattle and sheep are like goats. They'll eat anything, you know, in their path. So as the foreman, he was responsible for their well-being, and they would clean things up. So I don't know if it's a case of just trying to, you know, get a little publicity, but we had even paid her a visit up in Portland, Oregon on one occasion, and even her own husband at that time said that, "I'm sure she's not talking about the same incident." And she finally did recant. She finally agreed that she was not there, and that whatever her father had recovered had really destroyed him, that he was never the same person as a result.
No, once you see something like that, you become a different person.
And that might describe her reaction, her behavior in all this, because she was attempting to still get her dad back. She was trying to trivialize it. She was trying to suggest that there wasn't any reason for his behavior. And yet, deep inside, she knew there was. She just couldn't explain. She couldn't put her finger on it. And God knows she couldn't get him to talk about it.
Tell me about the story of the so-called midget in the jailhouse that surprised the JAG officer. This is something.
This was a story that was told to us about 3 years ago. I think the lead came into the museum, if I recall. And the story is that there was a JAG officer that's, I forget what that stands for, Judge Advocate General.
Judge Advocate General. That's
yeah,
right.
A lawyer. An Air Force lawyer, Army Air Force
or
lawyer.
Or Navy, same thing.
Yeah. And he was given orders. He was in Washington, practicing his trade in Washington, and he was given orders to fly to Roswell, New Mexico. And this was at the time just after the incident. And so, you know, okay, yes, sir. And so he flies to Roswell. And he deplanes there, and he's taken over to the hangar, where he can still see some of this wreckage in the hangar that they brought in from the crash sites, bunch of wreckage. And she's like, that's interesting. And so he's then taken over to the guardhouse, and so he figures, oh boy, I'm here to defend somebody. You know, an airman who was misbehaving, so that's what he thought. So he goes in, and they lead him into one of the holding tanks there, and here is this little, he called it a little man, you know, three and a half feet tall in this fatigue. They had him in a fatigue, army fatigues that were way too big for him.
Was he proportioned?
Well, he between the shock and the camouflage, he was in the army fatigues that were way too big for him, so he couldn't really judge proportions other than the large head. That's what stood out, was the large head. And he can't believe this. It's also wearing a fatigue type hat, so it's got part of its head covered up, but he can see the overwhelming feature here is a large head on a very small